session number 27342, reel 7.
Jack Thomas, reel 7.
So we're just 7 on. Well, on our way back, the Campania was going to pay off for a time for a refit. So we came back without any particular trouble at all, apart from that flight I mentioned, did the normal patrols, and came back to Belfast for the Campania to have a refit. Well, the idea was that the fighter planes flew off early on, and we had also on board one ancient fairy, Fulmar, which was carried on board officially as a night fighter plane. It had night fighting equipment on. It was an elderly aeroplane, but nevertheless it was there. So when we got about, I suppose, 50 or 60 miles off the Irish coast, they thought they'd fly the Fulmar away, off. So the Fulmar pilot observer thought they'd have some fun. So they loaded the plane up with toilet rolls. And after they took off, they bombarded the ship. And there were toilet rolls on the mast everywhere, all over the place. And then off they went. 10 minutes later, they came back. The engine started to miss. They had to land on again. It was rather like a Bateman cartoon. The captain leant over the edge of the bridge, just beckoned two of them as they came up the deck. So we killed ourselves with laughing at that. Then next thing, funny thing was, we entered the Belfast and we sailed up the lock and into the docks. And of course, we had all our kit with us. Well, we had to get back to Maydown, so we had to take all our kit with us. Now, a swordfish will carry almost anything. The original name string bag for a swordfish came because it was like granny's string bag, which would carry anything you put in it, just stretched accordingly. And so we got the planes loaded up. I had a cabin trunk strapped between the undercarriage legs, another cabin trunk in the observer space at the back, with the observer sitting on top of it with his G-string, which was his security thing, chained to the bottom of the cockpit. The air gunner had two cases jammed in beside him in the back there. We had some kit bags strapped on the bomb racks on the sides of the wing. And I had my small little ditty box, which all sailors had, little suitcase. Well, I had that in the cockpit with me, so I didn't quite know what to do with this. So I had to sort of hold it. And then when I wanted to pull the stick back, I had just to lift the case up. I was flying. It was rather funny, that. Anyway, they craned us off the side of the docks and spread the wings. And then we taxied out of the docks, out of the dock gate, into the street, taxied down the street till we got to Sydenham Aerodrome, which is a bit further round, taxied into the aerodrome. It must have looked funny for these people in the town, seeing four swordfish coming through the town. See, we went into the Sydenham Airport and to take off. And I remember thinking, well, I've got a lot of load on here. There'll be a lot of, drag, really, more than anything else. The weight didn't matter. So I took it right to the very end of the runway, put the brakes on full throttle, belted down the runway, and I thought, I'm never going to get airborne here. And it took nearly the whole runway to get airborne. And we got into the air, and dead ahead of me was a church spire. And I thought, no way dare I bank the plane. And I just had to wait. And we were just a little bit of drift on. And we drifted past it very nicely. And then the next thing was Belfast. Belfast? It's in a bit of a hollow in the north side where we were going to Maydown. There's like a range of hills and the road goes out over a kind of col there. And I thought, I've got to get over there. I thought, if it's a double-decker bus coming over there, I'm not going to make it. It was so low. And I was all the way to Maydown before I got to 1,000 feet, and had to come down again. So that was the end of that trip. And that was a funny one, that one. Well, after this, again, we split up, and I was hanging about a bit. I did a bit of ferrying, and then I thought, well, I want to get on with something. And there was a call came for anyone who would like to train as a batsman, a deck landing control officer. They'd do a short batting course there at Maydown. Now, normally, the batsmen were trained at Arbroath. There was a proper batsman training school, and a chap called Everett, Lieutenant Commander Everett, was the chief batsman there, and he was brilliant. I mean, he could... he could sort of somehow have a psychological contact with any pilot he was coming in, and he could control them absolutely. A wonderful batsman. It was said, a bit apocryphal, that he could put a penny on the runway and bounce the aircraft's hook on the penny, But he could certainly put them down anywhere he wanted. Well, I didn't do the long batting course. I did this short batting course, which is about a fortnight, at Maydown. And learned the batting, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I found I had a knack for it, and it just came. It was great. Really went well. And then I had to do my night batting. And this was amusing because at night time you had, instead of your two bats, you had two lamps in sort of little holders on which held one in each arm, and another lamp strapped to your chest so that the pilots could see the relative position of the three lights to say whether you're going, otherwise you couldn't at all what they meant by the signals, you see. And you judge the plane by the by attitude. And I went down to the runway to do this, and there was a chap, he was the CO of the Dutch squadron who was operator there as well, Lieutenant Commander Van den Toeren, I remember him. And he was a very sociable sort of gent, and he said to me, he had a series of big batteries by the side of the runway, and he sort of plugged into these with all his equipment. And he said, "Ah, you come to do the night batting?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Easy, just the same as daytime." He said, "All you do, watch the lights, keep them in the same attitude, you're okay, no problem. I'm going to the wardroom." And he handed the bats to me. And that was it. That was the only instruction I ever got. Now, the pilots who were going around, what we called the Mickey Mouse pilots, they were the ones who were sent to train the batsmen. You know, people were given that awful duty to go around and let the batsmen try their ability on them. They went for an hour. I batted these poor people in, luckily without any problems. But, I mean, anything could have happened. But so I just had to judge the position. I could see the tail light and the two wing lights, and you could tell, you know, the attitude of the aircraft from that, really. But that was it.
Describe the skills that you need as a batsman. What you
well, you need... you obviously need to be a pretty experienced pilot. You need to know the aircraft that that you're batting in. It's no good if you're a batsman who's trained on swordfish to go and straight away and bat wildcats without extra training, or without flying a wildcat. Because you know by the swordfish, I knew the attitudes of what it was like at different speeds and everything like that. You could sense what was going on to some extent. You needed to be confident about your own ability, but you also needed to be firm. You needed to know if a pilot obviously was going to make a hash of it, much better send him round again, get him settled down and do it properly, rather than say, "Oh, I'll get him in somehow," and drop him in from 40 feet or something like that, which some people did. The biggest problem was you had to be careful batting, because you had to be nimble and fit, because the batsman's position was on the port side of the ship, like a little metal platform that stuck out over the nets at the side. Now, when the plane came in on a Mack ship with a 45-foot wingspan swordfish on a 52-foot wide deck with 6 feet wide bridge sticking into it, you hadn't got a lot of leeway. And so the pilot's wingtip was usually not far off you when you came in. And if you came a bit to one side and dropped a wing, of course, it could decapitate you quite easily. So the thing was, you had a safety net at the side into which you were supposed to plunge if this happened. One of the problems was the net had a good 4-inch wide mesh on it, and should you jump into there and both feet go through two different holes in the net, it could be very uncomfortable indeed, as you can imagine. So the idea was to get an old mattress and put it at the bottom, so that didn't come. And the other thing was, if the plane crashed on top of you and caught fire, your only way out was through the side of the net onto the ship's side of the ship. So I always carried a knife. I had it was a World War I bayonet cut down to about 10 inches long and a razor sharp, and I carried that all the time. So I thought, if I ever get trapped in the net, I can slash it and get out. I never did, but that was the idea anyway. As well as landing the planes on, taking them off, it's your responsibility to get them off correctly at the right time. And what you tried to do was, if you assumed there was enough wind across the deck, if there wasn't, you couldn't take off. You had a series of signals to follow from the bridge. The air staff officer was in overall charge of landing and takeoffs, and he said yes or no to start with and put the appropriate flags up. And when I was batting, in the sort of the nets in front of where I was standing, there was a sort of well, we call it like a walkway along. I had a talker, and he was one of the ratings. He was a stores assistant, actually, and his job was to keep me in contact with the bridge, because the bridge was behind me. And we had a very simple, foolproof, non-technological method of communication. If he wanted to attract my attention, he took my trouser leg. Very effective. He had a phone down there, one of those wind phones you wind around, and he could contact the bridge, you see. So he kept in touch that way for landing on. And the bridge would warn you, you see, or he would warn me, say there was a big swell coming up ahead and the ship was going to pitch, which I couldn't see with my back to the bows. He could let me know and I could look around and see it. But taking off, you had to, again, watch the whole thing. You had to go well down the deck, The plane, you rev the plane up. We had two flags, a red and a green flag. And red for stop and green for go, obviously. Well, you wound him up on his brakes with the green flag. And then you watched and you waited till the ship was at a position where the bows had just come, just about coming up to the top of the lift. And we're just about to start to go down. Gave him the green flag, so he had a bit of a downhill run. And by the time he got to the bows, they were coming up again. And he just gave him that little bit of extra lift. So that was quite, you know, you had to have the feel of the ship as well. And then later on, when they got rockets, rocket-assisted takeoff gear, that was very helpful because, I mean, that boosted you into the air. You get into the air level with the bridge, you didn't even have to get to the bows, providing the rockets went off or providing both went off. If one went off, it could be very nasty.
How did that work?
They were electrically fired, but he pressed a button on the control column. And when you got, now what you did, the batsman was about three quarters of the way down the deck, and you wound him up again, got him to start with your green flag, but then you used your red flag then, held that up, and when you brought the red flag down, he pressed the button. To start with, the air staff officer now used to have graphs and mathematical calculations about where you fired the things to get out of the and marks on the deck and everything. After a bit, you got to the stage where you knew in different conditions when to press the button, so you did it. But the pilot always waited till you told him. A friend of mine, Alan Spencer, who was the senior pilot of the flight, waved him off one day, and as he went off, his port rocket didn't fire. And starboard one did, and he cartwheeled nimbly into the sea, landed alongside the ship, and was bobbing around on the surface. And about a dozen people ran to the side and shouted down, "Are your depth charges fused?" Because if they had been, and it had sunk, it would have blown the bottom out of the ship. So he sort of shook his head rather sorrowfully and was bobbing around in the water. And anyway, the ship went on, and the rescue ship came up and got him out all right. The funny thing was, Alan was still busy unfastening his straps. His observer loosed himself quickly, and by putting one foot on Alan's head, he got onto the climbing net on the side of the ship more quickly. He got out without even getting his feet wet, and Alan was submerged underwater. He wasn't too happy about that.
Were all batsmen ex-pilots?
Yes. Oh, yes, you had to be a pilot to be a batsman. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had to really know the aeroplane. Later on, I think when they developed mirror landing gears and things like that, I think it was different because they were, well, it was controlled electronically and mechanically, you know. But this was very much a personal thing, and I must say I enjoyed batting. I batted about 200 odd deck landings, and I never had an accident, so that was, I was quite pleased about that.
Is it not a dangerous job?
It could be, because you see, if you drop the plane, dropped a wing on a Mack ship, certainly, because there's no room at all. On a big carrier, the batsman was, I mean, there was 8 or 9 feet before the plane's wingtip, sort of thing. But if he got a little bit to one side, his wingtip would be on you, you see, so you had to duck or whatever, you see, duck or die was the thing, wasn't it?
Did you wear any special clothing?
Well, I did. That's just something I invented. This is one of my inventions, this. I decided that. First of all, I thought a night batting is better because you've got the triangulation of the three lights. And daytime, with just two bats, with small movements in misty weather, you couldn't really tell exactly whether the bats were up or down compared with the neutral position. So I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll get a third disc from a spare bat and wear it on a harness on my front. So I had three discs in line. And the pilots liked that. They said that was great because they could tell, even if the visibility was poor, they could see whether I was shaped like that or shaped like that. So it was a fairly simple thing, but it was very. And didn't know anybody else who did it, but I did. It just struck me, you know, that was a useful thing. Also, I wanted to be as visible as possible, so I always wore. I had a bright red rugby shirt, and I think I was the first person in the Navy to wear what do they call it? A cap. You know, the American style cap.
Baseball cap.
You had a baseball cap with a blue and yellow checks on it. I used to wear that and this red thing. And I obviously stood out like anything. And when the visibility was bad, Alan used to say to me, "So I'd always see you. As soon as I see the ship, I can see you there. I know we're all right, yes." So I thought that was quite interesting, that. But I never mentioned that anybody else who did that, but it just seemed to me an obvious sort of thing to do.
Because later on, coloured. clothing was warm, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. They had all the Americans had all sorts of wonderful colouring things. As I said, the American system was different. It was an information system, whereas ours was a command system. And yet at the end of the war, after the war, or perhaps maybe the Korean War, they went over for a short time to the American system. I don't know why. I never knew why, because I never thought it was as efficient. And then, of course, they brought in mirror landing gear and things like that, where the batsman became, to that extent, redundant. He merely controlled the landings and talked them in. Of course, the system's totally different now. The thing is, when we landed a plane, as soon as you gave the cut, he stopped, chopped the throttle right back, slowed down as quickly as possible. Now, as soon as they touch down, they open the throttle right up, in case they miss the wire, because a jet is slower in picking up than a propeller-driven aircraft, and they need the impetus to take off again. And of course, with the angled flight deck, they could land and take off at the same time. So, I mean, it must be a luxury on these big carriers. I reckon you could land a swordfish across the deck of one of these big American ones. Yeah.
Was it tiring, actually, holding the bats?
Well, it could be if you're doing it for quite a bit. But, I mean, you've got, say, four planes to bring down. You'd bring them down fairly quickly. You'd get them down, each one down in about a minute and a half, and taxi forward the next one. The great thing is to try and get them down as quick as possible. That was because the longer you were sailing on a straight course, the more dangerous danger you were in as the carrier from a torpedo or something like that as well. The carriers usually operated from what was called a box in the convoy, which covered miles each way. There was a big open square towards the stern of the convoy, and the carrier sat in there. There was room for him to manoeuvre there. But sometimes, if there was not enough wind, they'd have to get out of that, out of the convoy altogether, to find a wind to get enough to get across the deck. But, in fact, when these two ships that were sunk on my last trip, which was about a month before VE Day, I think it was, the carrier was in the box, and one of these ships was torpedoed, and a lot of the ships closed in on us, sort of for safety sort of thing, and we couldn't get the planes, couldn't get any planes airborne. So we couldn't follow, so the second ship was torpedoed as well, so it was hard luck, it was very bad luck. But literally, they were the only two ships sunk, and that was, a week before month before V Day.
Mm. It's interesting with the batsman's job. It sounds incredibly responsible for the amount of training that you had, really.
Yes, you learnt on the job, to some extent. I suppose, I mean, I'm trying to boast about it, but I think I must have had a bit of a knack for it. It must have been, came to me fairly naturally. And as I say, I enjoyed it as well. But it was very responsible because, I mean, you know, if you pranked somebody, well, you feel responsible for it anyway. And not a very nice thought.
But it sounds like it's almost a feel for it, like you said, for the feel for an aircraft.
Definitely. I would say that without a doubt. That it's not just going through the motions, the actions. You've got to somehow have a rapport with the person you're bringing in. You feel you're projecting yourself onto him. You're thinking of him as if you're in the cockpit yourself. And that's important, very important. You can't do it in a mechanical manner, like I'll just go through certain motions and hope he follows them. You've got to grab him as a thing, as it were. I wrote a poem about this. I write poetry, by the way. I wrote a poem about a batsman called Batsman's Ballet, which I thought gave the feel of it. I can tell you that later if you like. It was something quite special, really. Yes, and then after when the German war finished, of course, that was the finish for the Swordfish. Then we were the last squadron still flying Swordfish at the end of the war, and we had a very sad job of taking them away for breaking up. We flew them to either Barton at Manchester or Sherburn in Elmet, and. Just left them there and to rot away, really.
Were you being a batsman to the end of the war?
Yes, that was the end of the war. I was a batsman then, yes. Well, to the end of the German war. And then I retrained then, and I volunteered to go as a fighter pilot. Why, I don't know, but it was time of change. Actually, I missed flying as well. You know, because flying is something, once you do, you want to do it. So I thought, and I didn't know what the prospects were for a batsman keeping on about it, but carrying on after that. So anyway, I volunteered for a fighter course, and I went to Leon Solent and trained on Fireflies, which were a totally different aeroplane from the Swordfish. A very nice aeroplane to fly, a gentlemanly aeroplane, comfortable, all mod cons, you know, heating in the cockpit, a glass lid, wheels that came up, you know, you didn't need heavy clothing at all, anything like that. comfortable seat. Oh, it was quite a revelation. You could trim the hands off and so you could fly, sit and watch the thing fly itself.
Was it a powerful aircraft in comparison with the Swordfish?
Not tremendously. It had the same engine as a Spitfire, the Merlin. Yeah. But then later on, the later ones had Griffins, and then they were quite powerful then. In fact, the ones with the Griffins were very effective aeroplanes. They proved their way in the end of the Japanese War when they took out the Palembang oil refinery. The Americans had been bombing it for about 2 years, and the Fireflies took it out in half an hour. But what they did, instead of aiming at the tanks, and which could be patched up and filled again, they blew the control rooms out of action by careful rocket fire, put the whole place out of action. But they were nice planes, but luckily they dropped the atom bomb before I had to go and fight with the Japs, so I didn't do it long enough. I was just training. But incidentally, funnily enough, back again at Inskip at 766 Squadron to do my training there. Yes.
Did it have any vices to fire flyers?
I don't think it did really. No, I wouldn't think so. Very very nice aeroplane. Quite a very good aerobatic aerocraft. Although I did give myself a fright in it once when I was doing my training, in my first training, I got into an inverted spin. I was telling you about that. I didn't realise till I'd lost about 10,000 feet, and I realised it was the other way around. I came out about 1,000 feet up over the Isle of Wight, doing, I don't know what speed I was doing, but the airspeed indicator needle was up against the stops. And remember, this sounds funny, but it's true. It was an American plane, a Lightning, and a twin boom plane fly, and I passed him. I don't know what speed I was doing, I don't know, but I was howling through the air at terrible speed. And when I got out of the ground, I was a bit twitchy, and it put me off for a bit of that. But anyway, but
how had you got into the spin?
Well, I was doing practicing spinning, and I think something went wrong with the control, with the way I pushed the controls. But normally it was very very nice for flying in, and you had your observer in the back, so you had company. You see, it was like a single-seater fighter. Because I took my hat off to single-seater people, because they navigated did their own navigation, you know, flying over the sea with a small pad on their knee and doing the calculations as they went. It's awesome doing that.
It's quite interesting, because I know that story you told before about meeting up with a Wildcat pilot.
Yes.
That struck me then as an interesting fact, because obviously he must have been navigating himself.
He was navigating himself. Quite a frightening thought, that I always think that anyway. Yes. Yeah. And whereas we had the observers doing all the hard work. But they're nice, the Fireflies, though. They were good fun to fly. And the last flight I ever had in a Firefly was the last flight I did during the war. There was something had gone wrong with the hoods. They found somebody had bailed out and had an accident, because when he released his hood, it came down before it went up, and it cut him across the top of the head and gave him a nasty cut on the head. So they took all the hoods off the Fireflies to check them. And I had to do a flight without a hood on. It was like being back in the Swordfish again with the open air.
Did you do any practice firing with the Firefly?
Yes, with 20mm cannon. We had 4 20mm cannon. Oh. And they would also carry rockets and things as well. But we used the cannon mainly, yes. They were very good. Nice aeroplane, yes. But as I say, I just really finished the training of those. And then after that, I went to various places, did some odd courses, getting ready for Civvy Street, really, more or less.
Did you think of staying on at all?
No, because I thought I was probably living on borrowed time. As I said, I'd had 5 prangs, and I thought, I wonder, you know. And like everything else, you know, you wanted to see what was going to happen after the war, what was going to go on.
So what was the courses they put you on? Did they give you?
I had a choice of a number. One of them was a course at the Cotton Exchange in Liverpool. I didn't really know what that meant even, so I wasn't interested in that. But there was a teacher training course, and I went on that and did a month's teaching practice in Butler Grammar School in Warrington, under the auspices of the Navy. And in fact, I went in for teaching as a career when I came out.
So they actually got the training via the Navy.
It started off at the beginning there, yes. And some of the early lessons I had in that sort of month or so was very, very effective. The chap who took was a naval officer. And, he'd been a teacher before the war. He was very, very good. I remember two things I always remember. We were in the classroom, we had a lecture one day, and he came in grumbling under his breath, and he sort of kicked the blackboard. The blackboard fell down, and he cursed, and he put it up again. And he turned to him and said, don't let your ill feeling affect your teaching. Another time he said, he's standing like this, his hand in his pocket, and he said, it is essential, if you say you're going to do something, you do it. Never say something you'll do and then don't do it. He said, if you say you're going to kill somebody, you kill them. And he pulled out a revolver and fired it at us with a blank cartridge. He said, if you say I'll shoot you, you shoot him, he said. And, you know, we ducked for cover. But I remembered that, always remembered that stuff, you see. Never say something you're going to do and you can't do it, you can't carry it out.
And how did you get demobilised then? What was the process?
Went to a play, I can't remember what it was now, it was one HMS Gosling, I think, one of the naval places around in the sort of general Manchester area. We had our civvy suit and various bits and pieces and some coupons and things, and away we went, and that was it. We were supposed to be on reserve for so long, and then I think when I was 30 or something like that, they told me they were no longer required, sort of thing. Some people I know went into the RNVR air squadrons afterwards, and some of them actually went. Jock McCandless went in back into the Navy again and was flying in Korea. And as I say, this Judge Buxton went out to Korea as well. But I never flew again till 1994, I think it was, and I went to Carnarvon Airport with one of our jollies of one of our local association, and they said, anybody want a flight? So I said, yes, I'd like a flight. So I went up in a Piper Cherokee, a little low-wing monoplane. Do you know the Cherokee? Low-wing monoplane with a steering wheel and everything. And the instructor said to me, right, when you're ready, taxi out to the end of the runway and take off. So I taxied out. And I said, well, what's the stalling speed? I thought, that's fairly important. So he told me. So we took off, climbed. He said, climb to 1,000 feet and then circle the aerodrome. I go up to about 1,200 feet and fly it around. And he just let me fly the thing. And it was like driving a car, because you just turn the wheel and you turn. You couldn't go wrong. Anyway, so I flew around for about half an hour. And he said, now I want you to go back and join the circuit at 800 feet. So I did. He said, any minute now, I thought he was going to say, right, I've got her, you see. He said, when you're ready, just land it as near as you can to the end of the runway, you see. So, all right, huh? So I went down, closed the throttle, went down, and with a tricycle undercarriage, you don't have to stall it in. You just fly till you're on the ground and cut the throttle. It was a bit of a crosswind, so I kept one wing up a bit and got it level, touched down, nice smooth landing, taxied in. He said, nice landing, that. He said, when did you last land an aircraft? I said, I think it was 49 years ago. Why? He said... He said it must be like riding a bike.
One last question, Jack. Uh-huh. How do you feel now about having served with the Fleet Air Arm in the war?
Oh, I'm very pleased I did. There were a special bunch of people. As I said, there's always this old school feeling, everybody knows everybody else. We felt on our own in the Navy, as a certain part of the Navy of our own, not like the regular Navy. We're definitely different from the crabs, as we call the RAF, the light blue boys. People have kept together very well, and we've got all over the country. We've got these first of the month groups of people who meet. We meet on board the Mersey group. We meet on board HMS Eaglet in Liverpool. It's the Stone frigate there. It's the RNR headquarters. Once a month, and we have a lunch on board in the wardroom. It's very pleasant. We shoot lines and push the lamp a bit, you know. And really, I mean, I'm one of the youngest ones at 80, so it's incredible. Really, they're the liveliest bunch of octogenarians you've ever met in your life. They haven't grown up since they left the Navy, you know.
Thank you very much.